agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University. I am joined, as usual, by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, welcome back to The Politics Guys.
Thanks, Trey. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's always fun when we are the ones taking things over. And this week is no exception. We've got a lot on deck. We're going to talk about the most recent news related to Navarro and his contempt for Congress conviction. We're going to talk about the Proud Boys sentencing and some of what I saw as being some of the surprising responses to it. We're going to pivot from there and turn to Texas, get a little bit more local, although maybe a little bit less often happening, the impeachment of Attorney General Ken Paxton. From there, we're going to talk about some shock deficit numbers that came up this week and the doubling of the deficit at the national level. We're going to turn then, as we often do, to international story and to Mexico's Supreme Court decision involving abortion. And then because this was, in fact, the week of Labor Day, we're going to do a Politics Guys tradition, although it's the first time for Ken and myself to be doing it. And we're going to talk about labor in the United States and the state of labor in the United States. So that's what we've got on deck this week. So, Ken, I thought we'll jump right in with Peter Navarro. On Thursday, a jury found former Trump advisor Peter Navarro guilty of contempt of Congress. At issue was his defying a subpoena issued in February of 2022 by the House Committee on the January 6th Capitol attack. Now, as has been noted, this comes after Steve Bannon was already sentenced to 4 years in jail for similarly defying that same committee and another subpoena. Now, the fundamental argument from Navarro was that Trump had instructed him to invoke executive privilege. Now, after the decision, Navarro said, that's why this is going to the appeals court. This is going to the Supreme Court. I said from the beginning, I'm willing to go to prison to settle this issue, end quote. So the ultimate question that's getting set up is, did the committee have to discuss this with Trump to determine executive privilege in advance, as Navarro claims, or, as prosecutors obviously successfully argued, that he still had to show up to the deposition and cite the privilege on a question-by-question basis? So the court had not allowed him to use that executive privilege argument, although we need to be careful, Ken and I, we've talked about this before, there really isn't a singular thing known as executive privilege. But in this case, what he's arguing is that the deliberative decision-making process privilege that he had with Trump is not able to come out before Congress. So those decisions then should be shielded because Trump then told him not to do it. But again, there's a lot, we've talked about that before. We talked about Bannon. So Ken, is there any really thing new here from the Bannon to the to the Navarro case?
No, I don't think so. And I would like to, just clarify for the listeners the contours of executive privilege. So there is such a thing as executive privilege, and privilege is related to certain communications between the president and his top advisors that relate to the scope of the president's duties, right? So those kinds of communications don't necessarily have to be disclosed. But in Navarro's case, his argument was so frivolous that the judge didn't even allow him to make it to the jury that this could apply, because in order to invoke executive privilege, two things that you'd have to have, which Navarro didn't have at all. One is there'd have to be some evidence that the president was claiming the privilege. That was just totally lacking here. Trump never said that he was invoking executive privilege, and the president would have to exoke. He wouldn't necessarily have to testify about it and say, go under oath and say, I'm invoking executive privilege. But he'd at least have to submit a document or something to the Congress saying that he's claiming executive privilege. We actually have no reason to believe that Trump ever claimed any executive privilege over any of these communications. And the privilege belongs to Trump, not to Navarro. And then the secondary thing is Navarro did not show up when he was subpoenaed. And there are many things that he could have been asked about where it wouldn't have been possible for executive privilege to apply, because executive privilege could only apply to discussions that he had with the president. But he could have been asked about other things.
Like other things he produced and gave to other people, for example.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, he could have even been asked, you know, did you have a job as a White House economic advisor? You know, he should have answered yes to that. He shouldn't have said, I can't answer that because of executive privilege. Right. There's no confidential communication at issue in questions like that. And so it would so his refusal to answer any questions, combined with his lack of evidence that Trump ever did claim executive privilege, meant that he had no executive privilege argument whatsoever. And there's a 0% chance that the D.C. Circuit will reverse this case. And I would say a 0% chance that the Supreme Court will even take this case. But I think that the real issue here, which is kind of a new development ever since Trump pardoned Manafort and Bannon and Roger Stone, really, like, the whole concept of taking an appeal now is not that there's any merit to the appeal, but it's just playing for time, you know, throwing the Hail Mary pass that, maybe Trump or a Trumper will take the White House and give a pardon before Navarro ever has to go to prison. That's his whole entire strategy here.
So, in effect, I mean, and you are probably one of the most critical of the Supreme Court, and your answer is, like, they're not even going to get this case up.
No, this one's way too trivial. It's not. There's literally no evidence from which anyone could look at that record in this trial and say that there was executive privilege here. As I say, no, he didn't. His blanket refusal to show up meant that he was exercising contempt of Congress, even with respect to questions that they might have asked him that wouldn't have implicated executive privilege. And also, you know, you have to actually get a document some evidence from the president that the president claimed the privilege.
What do you think his advantage is? You know, oftentimes when I take a look at these circumstances and this exceeds the legal standing, I'm often curious about the human behavior element of it, and what he thinks he is going to be winning or losing in the future for taking this this particular position. And for me, I think that's one of the things. I think with Bannon, I sort of understood. But the Navarro, I'm just not positive that I have a good grasp of, you know, if somebody said to me, well, what do you think he's going to gain out of this? I mean, I recognize there is always, of course, kind of the orbit of Trump. But that doesn't feel like it's a full enough explanation to say, and I think your commentary there on the okay, we're holding out for the pardon, okay, fair, but at the same time you have to recognize, I mean, he's not an idiot, that's not a guaranteed possibility, since, I mean, you're hoping that the White House is going to flip. So do you think there's other things to be won here? Why take such the frivolous position at the outset? What's the advantage? I mean, again, for me, I wish I could float an answer to my own question, but I don't think I have a good one.
I think it depends on what you define as the outset, right? So if you define the outset as, you know, why did he refuse to show up when the House subpoenaed him? I think he did not believe there was a serious chance he'd be held accountable, right? I mean, at this time, you know, Trump was still the president. There were a number of Republicans in Congress, and they were expecting more pickups than they got. First in the 2018 midterm, and then in the 2020 election, and then in the 2022
okay.
midterm. Yeah.
I was going to say, wait, I'm a little confused now, but that's okay.
I got my dates wrong. I mean, yeah, both in 20 and in 22, the Republicans expected more pickups. You know, I think they just didn't think that. I think he never contemplated at the time that he didn't show up in response to the subpoena that Congress would ever hold him accountable by voting contempt against him, or even if they did, that any White House would ever actually enforce it. And I think the other thing that made him think that is just how minor the penalty is for the offense, right? So it would be a big deal for the Justice Department to pursue this prosecution. And, you know, he has been convicted, and under the sentencing guidelines, you know, he might, you know, pay a fine or possibly serve like a week or two in prison, but it's not a major offense. So I think he thought the minorness of the offense would mean that nobody would pursue it. So I think if you look at that outset, he kissed up to Trump because he didn't believe that he would end up having to pay this price that he's actually paying.
And he, and the price itself is relatively low.
Is relatively low. And then I think now, if you ask, well, once he's been indicted and you know, why doesn't he just plead guilty? Why is he going through with all this? You know, there again, I think it's a similar calculus that because it's a relatively low penalty for a conviction, especially for someone with a clean criminal record, a first offender, someone who's not a gang member, you know, et cetera. You know, I think he probably figures there's not that much better of a deal that he could get from pleading guilty than from pleading not guilty. Probably the best thing he could get from pleading guilty would be a guarantee that he's not going to prison, but he'd still be a felon. He still might have to pay a fine. He'd still probably have to talk to a probation officer. And so if you add the chance that he might have to go a week or two to prison if he goes to trial, you know, I don't know that he sees that as a hugely higher cost to pay. And meanwhile, he's a hero to the Trumpers, you know, and I think he will find ways to monetize this and to get other benefits out of it.
So we're going to get the maybe the book in the future. I was in prison by the left.
Yeah. And if Trump or any Trumper comes back into the White House, he's probably going to be, you know, maybe back in again and things like that. He doesn't have to deal with, you know, Trump generally. You look at like the Michael Cohen types who turn against Trump, and then they have to deal with the opprobrium of Trump and all the Trumpers. And, you know, Navarro's not having to deal with that. So to me, those kind of things are playing into his calculus. And I do think the relatively light penalties are certainly playing a role in how he weighs that calculus.
Well, why don't we kind of expand this conversation then and take in part of story two, which was the Proud Boys sentencing this week, or really the polarization of it and the politicalization of it this week. So now, just for setup for everybody, you know, I follow a lot of people on the right on X, you know, the social media site formerly known as Twitter. And, you know, the jokes just keep coming for that one. But one of the reasons I do that, I mean, students ask me this, others, I want to understand. I mean, that's part of what I do as a political scientist. I'm curious about those spaces. I'm curious about spaces on the left, on the right, and that sometimes helps you understand what might be coming down the line. And so I can't say that it was really initially shocked when I saw those particular channels coming up with the reactions from this week's Proud Boys sentencing. Which honestly, you know, when it finally then made its more mainstream version of it later this week, that was the part that morphing that was a little bit more shocking to me. So while I do have a little bit of sympathy for some part of this argument, we'll get there. My basic take is that this is kind of a weird turn, and it maybe goes into what you were talking about in terms of Navarro. So let's kind of back up, go through the details. So on January 6th, Proud Boy members took to the streets and to the Capitol in an effort that was organized by Enrique Tarro and the leader of the Proud Boys. And after a number of sentences for other Proud Boys, which ranged from 10 to 17 years, depending on the number of felonies, and importantly, a few of them were not able to be found, were not found guilty of sedition charges. So whether or not they had the sedition charges changed those terms. Now, Enrique was sentenced to 22 years in prison on Tuesday on two counts. And part of what took some observers by surprise was that Judge Timothy Kelly ruled that the Proud Boys' actions represented terrorism since it amounted to, quote, the unlawful use of force or violence against persons or property to intimidate or coerce a government or civilian population in furtherance of a political or social objective. And by the way, that is pretty much just the FBI's definition of terrorism. So this sent both the defendants, who argued that it wasn't terrorism, and a lot of right-leaning political commentators, to argue that this is counter to the kinds of sentences that generally get doled out by the Justice Department, specifically in relations to the Black Lives Matter protests. So in response to this, as a matter of fact, if anybody wants to take a look at this, the AP ran a study and found that, in fact, when you take a look at the BLM protests, that 120 defendants pled guilty or were convicted at the federal level, and that the average was 27 months behind bars, with 10 receiving 5 or more years in prison sentences. Now, the one specific area where the AP found things to be a little bit different was in Portland, Oregon. And in that particular case, 60 of the 100 cases were actually mainly sent to what's generally called deferred resolution agreements. That's effectively where you kind of agree, it's your first offense. I'm not going to get any other trouble. I'm going to do certain actions. I'm going to report in. And if I do that, then the charges get dropped. So this past Tuesday, there's a lot of sympathy for Enrique. And then what got weird is, of course, yesterday when presidential candidate Ron DeSantis got in on it. So he argued on Newsmax this week that his White House would look into all these cases of what he called, quote, a protest that devolved into a riot, end quote, to uncover the many people, quote, that should not have been prosecuted, end quote. He'd go on to say that, quote, they just walked into the Capitol. If they, and in this case he's meaning Black Lives Matter, they would not have been prosecuted, end quote. Now, that may be because they were violent, as he went on to say, but it's not an act of terrorism, which was basically a protest that devolved into a riot to do these excessive sentences. So again, I'm just summarizing DeSantis there. So DeSantis would go on to argue that they may be guilty, but that 22 years is obsessive. Now, for those who may or may not know, DeSantis is actually a former Navy JAG lawyer. So his background is on this front. And so he was arguing, look, we need a standard of justice. So if you elect me, one of the things he is actively running on then, and this is the part that I was a little surprised about, or maybe a lot surprised about, he's now running to say, look, we're going to use pardons and we're going to commute sentences if I'm elected to make this equal to what we see happening with BLM. You know, and one of the things that came out of this as well has been a commentary that says, look, individuals are being more excessively punished if they don't do plea bargains in advance. Now, this is actually an area, Ken, you know, where I'm going to actually talk about some of my students. My students kind of did some early studies about a year ago where they were really curious about this issue of plea bargaining and all of that. As a matter of fact, plea bargaining in and of itself is pretty much the American justice system. And that's not unique to this case, but I will plug my students who did some mathematical work to figure that out. So Ken, I mean, obviously, maybe you're not as surprised as I was on some of these fronts. Maybe you were. But it did seem a little shocking for me that a candidate would come out and say, hey, look, one of my first orders of business is going to be potentially to commute or to pardon some Proud Boys. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you covered so many things there.
I know it's so much. I get it. I'm sorry. Yeah.
I think I want to respond both to the issue about the use of pardons, and also just to the merits of the sentences. But did you only want me to respond to one of the others of those two things?
Oh no, or, please. Yeah, okay. I was trying to set both things up. So please do.
So on the pardons first, because that's where you ended, but also that's goes along with the we were just talking about Navarro. I think this is an assault on the rule of law that is probably the most serious that I've ever seen, where you have the idea that if people engage in various crimes, whether it's crimes of fraud like the fake electors or violent crimes like the ones that were initiated at the Capitol on January 6th, and then they know that they may have to go through a court proceeding because they can be charged with those crimes, but we're viewing kind of they're viewing the criminal court proceeding as like a way station, a theatrical way station on the roll to a presidential pardon and judges as kind of just the props in a public spectacle before the strong man who is in power just lets them off because he was carrying out their political hatchet work. I think that is the most sustained attack on the rule of law that I've actually ever seen. And so that may sound like a strong statement, but you know, in Watergate, you know, Nixon of course got pardoned, but nobody even talked about pardoning all the other Watergate criminals, and they all went to prison. And similarly, you know, in the Iran-Contra, Reagan and Bush were never held accountable at all. But other figures like Oliver North, you know, were prosecuted. And although he ultimately was able to get his conviction reversed because of Fifth Amendment violations, where he was compelled to testify in Congress and then those words were improperly used against him, that was all part of a judicial proceeding. Nobody pardoned Oliver North. And the idea that, you know, the pardon is there to be be used so that when presidents or authoritarian strongmen want to commit crimes and have their henchmen carry out their crimes, that the henchmen can receive the wink and the nod that, don't worry, nobody can ever hold you accountable for this. It does seem different in kind to me than anything we've seen before. Trump certainly signaled with his pardons of Roger Stone and Paul Manafort and Steve Bannon, you know, that's how he plans to use the pardon. I mean, I remember just, you know, a little more than maybe 30 years ago, you probably remember this, that although I know you're a little younger than me, when Bill Clinton pardoned Mark Rich, who was a major campaign contributor of his, that was seen as such a scandal that Congress was holding hearings about, you know, passing legislation to restrict the use of the pardon power.
Yeah, that's right.
And I would say, you know, pardoning someone who's a major campaign contributor because perhaps they gave a lot of money to a campaign is corrupt, but it's nowhere near as corrupt as pardoning people who are going out and committing violent crimes on behalf of illegitimate efforts by the president in power to overthrow an election.
Well, I don't agree with this one, but let's throw it out there because that's part of the narrative that's been here, right? But, you know, Enrique, he wasn't there, Ken, right? He was just planning it, right? And so, you know, should he get to have a little bit of commution? Or
well, he got
the heaviest sentence commuted a little bit.
I mean, he got the heaviest sentence of anybody because he was the planner and organizer, and in fact, because he was also the conduit through Roger Stone to the White House. And remember, his planning included things like having lots and lots of guns brought into nearby hotel rooms in Virginia, so that depending how things went, you know, he could give the order, and there could be the violence could have been escalated into heavy gun violence if the January 6th people had been actually met with more of a display of force than they were. And so, you know, the crimes that he was convicted of were, you know, I think he got given a sentence that was light under the sentencing guidelines. I think the sentencing guidelines suggested a 30-year sentence, and he got a 22-year sentence. And that was in part influenced by the judge's finding that so many of the other people convicted of the January 6th crimes had been given sentences that were much lighter than what the sentencing guidelines would call for, that it would be unfair to single out Tarrio and give him one that was as much as the sentencing guidelines called for.
Yeah, I think you've hit it, and this is probably one where we're not going to have a ton of space between us. It is strange to me that this is the hill. I mean, for DeSantis specifically, right? Like, I get, and you know, it's in my framework of Trump, right? And that's been a long time bugaboo of mine. And while I deeply disagree with some of the policies of DeSantis, it seems strange that this is the hill, right? Like, you know, this is going to be the hill. And it even seems strange on the front of, I get that he wants to make this connections to Black Lives Matter. And I get that he wants to come after the left. And I honestly think when you take a look at the AP study, that there are places around the country, Seattle, you know, being one of them, where you could make some arguments where, you know, those on the left, I don't think handled that as well as they could have. But the problem is that doing it in the context of Enrique just destroys all of that from, you know, there's no argument left anymore, you know, once you bring it into this context. And so I guess for me, unlike in the last one, I think I at least have a standard. And I think the answer is right now, you know, the Republican Party is effectively the Trump Party. And so it doesn't matter which of the candidates we're really talking about. Any of the candidates who really have an opportunity to win are either actually Trumpian in their ways, or assuming that they have to put on that garb in order to be able to carry the mantle on, at least in this particular election cycle. And because in this case, it is hard for me to think that Ron DeSantis actually believes this, and especially given that he's doing it on Newsmax. And again, that doesn't excuse him making those comments, but I think this is him trying to wear those clothes so that he doesn't continue to hemorrhage poll numbers.
I agree with that. Well, a couple of things just to, you know, maybe help put some of these things into context in terms of the sentencing. You mentioned that he was a JAG lawyer, and I find that interesting. I didn't actually know that.
But
one thing about the JAG, which is different than probably most people's intuition, is when most people think about military justice and the military courts, they probably think it will be, you know, tough. Because the, you know, the military is seen as tough, but actually there are no courts more lenient to defendants than military courts, and that's because part of the objective of military courts is to actually, you know, if they've got soldiers who are in the army, you know, the idea is to get them back to work and not to be locking them up for a long time. Like the army has very much of an objective to do that. So he may be used to more lenient justice and not tougher, stricter justice.
So maybe his background in this case also be reinforcing that particular view.
Right, okay, right. Okay. That's what I was going to say. I was actually going to toss him that bone and saying, you know, there's maybe based on his experiences as a JAG lawyer, he usually sees that the concept of a criminal justice system is to quickly rehabilitate people, because that's really how the JAG Corps treats soldiers who commit crimes. And the other thing about sentencing guidelines, I know you mentioned that he's complaining that they use some of the terrorism sentencing enhancements, which, you know, to some people might seem as though, but he wasn't convicted of terrorism, although he was convicted of sedition.
Right.
In the sentencing guidelines, it is the case, and this is true across all people who are sentenced in federal courts, that if conduct is proved in the trial that isn't necessarily the elements of the particular crimes that were proved, that conduct can be taken account of under sentencing guidelines. And in fact, the standard of proof is lower. So everybody knows that, you know, for a criminal for a defendant to be convicted of a crime, the jury has to find that the proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, that they have to be the elements all have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. But if there's facts in the record that are proved by the preponderance of evidence standard, in other words, more likely than not, the allegations are true, doesn't have to be reasonable doubt, then those facts can be taken into evidence in the application of the sentencing guidelines. So the sentence can reflect all the conduct that was proved, not just the conduct that was formed part of the elements of the crime. And the standard of proof is only more likely than not. So it's not at all uncommon for federal defendants to be sentenced, and some of the factors that are mentioned at sentencing may not track exactly with the elements of the crimes that they were convicted of.
So I'll be honest, that was an element that I didn't realize. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why something that he's trying to call out as unusual is actually not unusual. It's the norm all the time.
Gotcha. Well, that's a useful take that even I wasn't familiar with. Yeah, I the larger here is just the it is frustrating to a never Trumper Republican, former Republican, to see that the extent to which he won continues to win. That is just depressing to me. I mean, it's probably not as depressing to you. You're probably like, this is why we're all going to be Democrats one day and we'll win. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm just like, oh, we need to have
it's depressing to me to think that if a Republican wins, a lot of these guys might actually get pardoned. I think that's horrific, really.
I'll be honest, you know, personally, my hope is that this is one of those you make promises, but they're low on the priority list items, so that if they were to win. But I, in all honesty, I don't think DeSantis, as we had talked about, I don't think he has a lot of chance of winning.
No, he's not going to win.
Yeah.
No,
I mean, and we all know what Trump's going to do, because he signaled that from day one.
Yeah, I think he will pardon a lot of these people. I actually think he's more likely to pardon the Enrico Terrios of the world than the Peter Navarros of the world.
Well, because it's easier to understand.
Yeah,
I don't mean that as an insult. Like, I think that is, in his view, a straightforward.
Yeah, I also think he respects like the fact that these Proud Boys are out there using violence on his behalf. I think he respects that. Whereas I think he looks at all the paper coup plotters like Navarro as people who just launched harebrained schemes that failed, and he doesn't owe them anything. That's why he's not paying his legal bills to Giuliani.
Yeah. Well, and again, this isn't something, you know, Navarro is not something that Trump has even weighed into to this point. You'll notice that wasn't even part of our lead into the story. But
Yeah, and Trump could have kept him out of jail by giving him a piece of paper that said I instructed him to invoke executive privilege.
Right. He didn't even have to have, in that case, a pardon.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that in and of itself is telling in many ways. Well, you know, maybe we should move forward a little bit here, Ken. So we'll pause for just a second. We'll be right up, and we're going to be talking about Attorney General Ken Paxton of Texas and his impeachment. So, Ken, man, Paxton, he's a wild guy.
Yes.
You know, I was looking at this, and, you know, you were talking about watching it. I've been following it pretty closely. I didn't actually get to watch it the way we talked about before the show. But I did, in fact, you know, pop up all the articles impeachment. And it's okay. It's not often that you read, you know, a 20 some article impeachment against somebody and are just kind of gripped. You're like, okay, and what happened next? You know. So let's try to get through that for listeners and see what's going on. So Attorney General Ken Paxton, you might imagine, is a Republican. You know, again, it's Texas. But to kind of set up what's going on here. His impeachment begins because 70% of Republicans voted in against him in the Texas House, 121-23, right? That's, you know, again, remember, nobody wants to vote against their own party. Nobody wants to impeach their own member. So that kind of number is pretty incredible. And as we had talked about before the show, this is a really kind of unusual occurrence, whether it's Texas or otherwise. So in the Texas process, similar to the national process, this then leads you to a senatorial trial. So what are all the things that are coming up in this trial? Well, let's take a look and we'll go back. I'm going to need a deep breath for all of the issues. So what did Paxton do? Well, again, we have 20 articles of impeachment against him, and let's go through some of them. He had improper dealings with the real estate owner, Nate Paul, who he fixed things up for Nate Paul while Nate Paul was fixing things up for Paxton's mistress. He then used taxpayer funds to pay an outside law firm to try to help with the Nate Paul who fixed up for his mistress fix things up. Now, this also includes the protection of particular charitable organizations, the misuse of his powers to issue wrongful legal opinions to stop a foreclosure, again, for, you guessed it, Nate Paul. Have employees act contrary to the open records process, send an attorney after people who he did not like to the benefit of, again, you guessed it, Nate Paul, conduct sham investigations at taxpayers' expenses, conceal his own wrongful acts via illegal acts, not to mention a whole slew of issues dealing with just what he was doing with his mistress. And no, that's not a sexual innuendo. That's the the business side of things. Now, Paxton, on the other side, and this is kind of the crazy part, I didn't know about this until, of course, you know, even impeachment trial going on in Texas. But his defense is that he can't be prosecuted because of a piece of the Texas Constitution, which lawyers often call the prior term doctrine. Okay, so what was this? I had to look into this. I actually had to read the state constitution of Texas to find this out and look at some others. So in the Texas state constitution, what it kind of states is, look, if issues come out prior to an election, and there's some ambiguity about what that means, then voters know about the issue and decided to vote for you anyway, and therefore you're exempt from impeachment. Now, that portion of the Texas constitution, it's a bit unclear. So I kind of looked, like I said, looked at some other scholars' interpretation of it. And the big kind of breakdown is, does it mean your first ever election or does it mean your most recent election? Now, some of the things he's being impeached with are prior to his current election, but not all of them. So there's kind of some questions, even if wouldn't it apply or not. But nevertheless, Southern Methodist University professor of political science, Cal Gilson, said, it is ultimately up to Lieutenant Governor Patrick to arbitrate the meaning of those words, because in their system, instead of having the Supreme Court justice sit and try in the Senate, it's actually the Lieutenant Governor who does that and oversees the impeachment trial. But that really is the centrality of his claim. Now, to be fair, his lawyer says that all of these things are false, but it doesn't even matter that they're false because you can't bring them forward. But that's going to be the primary defense, at least at this point, that we've seen. And again, you know, learning something new. But if you want to have a lot of fun, you can head to senate.texas.gov and find the whole 20 impeachment articles right there. It's HR 2377. But so, Ken, what are your thoughts on this impeachment process?
Yeah, you know, I didn't know much about Attorney General Paxton. I knew he was a kind of national leader of the Christian right legal community, but I didn't know much about how he ran his office in Texas. And I really just started watching and listening to the impeachment trial because it's just such a rare opportunity to watch and listen to an impeachment trial, though I guess really probably more in the past 5 years than long before that. But
true story. I mean, like, what, this is number three, right? You know?
Yeah. But a couple of things that have kind of caught my attention. And I'll be interested in your thoughts on this, too, is that it seems to me that the one thing I kind of knew about Paxton before all this was that he was a leader of the Christian conservative legal community nationally. And it does seem like he was a magnet for people in that community to want to come to work for him. That, you know, for instance, he was a fiercely anti-abortion attorney general, and people who shared those views and who were competent lawyers, you know, saw it as a real plum job to get to go to work in his office. And he very kind of anti-LGBT type lawyer. And again, he kind of assembled, I think, a fairly earnest and fairly well-qualified staff of deputies, primarily who shared his views. And that's why they wanted to come work there. And it's interesting because I don't think too many of them shared his corruption or had much tolerance for his corruption. And so you have this weird spectacle where
they're upset.
all these people that he handpicked and hired, and they came to this job mainly because he was the guy, you know, not just because they wanted to work in a state attorney general's office, but more because they wanted to work for Ken Paxton because of the positions he was publicly taking and articulating. They all became the whistleblowers who are turning him in for all this corruption. And most of the witnesses that you see are his own deputies that he handpicked for these jobs and who are testifying, you know, at great length about how much they share his views and still share his views, you know, but just couldn't abide by the level of corruption that they were witnessing. And it's really quite a spectacle to see that. And so that's kind of one thing that's caught my eye about this whole thing.
Well, in some ways, I found there to be comfort in that, in a sense, right? And so in that sense, you had individuals who were like, look, this is what I thought you were doing and what you were purporting to do. And I think that not on this scale, but I do think that happens not just in politics. I think that happens across the board a lot. The person who oftentimes is the center of attention is generally there because they're making themselves the center of attention. And it doesn't always mean that they quite buy everything that they're doing. And maybe that might be part of this takeaway. This might be an example of Ken Paxton, kind of the fraud on that front. And I think you're right to note. I mean, and this is something, you know, we had talked about at the national level, you know, where we didn't really see a lot of people willing to cross to come after Trump. Here you see Republicans in Texas, I think, doing kind of the right thing and saying, like, we got to impeach this guy.
These are his deputies. I mean, in the Trump White House, you see that a little bit at the lower levels, I suppose. So,
but not at the level we're talking about here.
I guess with Trump, the White House counsel, you know, did try to, you know, stop a lot of the January 6th stuff internally, but we didn't really see that visibly until after the January 6th committee congressional hearings happened. But here we saw a lot of these people are filing anonymous whistleblower complaints and not coming out publicly and not knowing what was going to come of it. But eventually what came of all the anonymous whistleblower complaints is that there's this impeachment trial. So now they're all actually taking the stand and coming out in public and talking about all the very strange and very obviously corrupt things that Paxton was doing, primarily on behalf of Nate Paul, you know, and seemingly inexplicable other than in exchange for big bribes.
Yeah. You know, this is something else. I haven't done a study on this, and so I'm just going to kind of float this. I'm kind of curious. Have you noticed that there's an obvious, all right, let me pause. Not obvious, but does there seem to you also to be a sense, and I'm being careful here because I mean this in a real way, and this is not an attack on particular communities, but there is certain kinds of hiding of, maybe put it, sexual hiding, I don't know how to put that, is often related to lots of other misdeeds. Does that make sense what I'm trying to get at there, Ken? I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You're saying like the fact that he was having these affairs with a mistress doesn't surprise you now that you know that he was corrupt in other respects, that you'd almost expect that to be part of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and oftentimes that's the thing that comes out first, right? And then, you know, everybody's like, well, that's just, it's just, oh, that's just the relationship. And what I'm saying is that I think there's almost, I think the two often go together with individuals who have attention on them purposefully.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to know. I mean, I think, you know, the thing of having the mistresses, you know, I suppose a lot of politicians and elected officials, that's been an issue. And I think that may be true for ones who are not otherwise corrupt as well as ones who are otherwise corrupt. So I it's hard for me to make a generalization about that. But yeah, that part of it, I think, probably did contribute to why the whistleblowers in this particular case, you know, when you're talking about this particular group of really true believing Christian conservatives, I think to them, it made them even more likely that they would become whistleblowers when they saw, you know, the various infidelities along with the financial corruption.
Well, I'm going to try to keep us on track here today, Ken. So we need to move on to our next story. We'll leave Paxton, and I'm pretty sure the short remaining time of his term in office for the minute to turn to another big story that got broken earlier this week was from Jeff Stein from The Washington Post, which showed, which was a little bit of a shock when we take a look. We talked about this earlier in the year. As a matter of fact, I think that was, I think Mike and Jay were the ones who looked at that. Don't hold that to me. When we were trying to talk about and think about what's going on deficit-wise. So as the fiscal year ends, and that happens in September, and that's going to continue to be a big deal as we think about Congress, but we'll put that to the side for a minute. The deficit doubled from 2022. And again, you can take a look at Jeff Stein's work with The Washington Post for all the details on that breaking. So prior to 2020, COVID spending deficit numbers kind of rested under $1 trillion again. And again, what I mean by that is each year we were bringing in, you know, we were spending a trillion more, a little less than that, than what we were bringing in revenue. And then, of course, we have kind of the aberration of COVID. As a matter of fact, I remember, Ken, right before COVID, you and I had kind of a disagreement about how much the deficit mattered. And I was even trying to maybe bringing Trump a little bit more grief than you were on that front. Then in 2020, we have $3.1 trillion, not a big surprise given the kind of spending we saw. In 2021, we have $2.8 trillion. And then last year, there was where you might consider kind of a lull where things returned to normal at about $1 trillion. But this year, we doubled that from approximately $1 trillion to a little over $2 trillion. Now, again, I'm not taking a side on this one, but that is, as many has been reported, you know, that, of course, doesn't include the $400 billion that Biden wanted to do in student loan cancellation, which would have taken that to approximately $2.5 trillion. But anyway, we'll leave that there for a minute. So what makes this particularly profound is it's happening in a time of amazing growth, right? So right now we have surging interest rates from the Fed trying to kind of rein that in, to try to rein in inflation. And that has not created the potential anticipated recession. So that's a lot of growth going on. So that's what makes economists see this particular deficit issue is so particularly problematic, because what you is normally kind of reversed of what a normal Keynesian, which is pretty much all of our economists' model, right? Growth brings deficits down as businesses and consumers owe more in taxes. Then deficits grow in downturns. But this doesn't happen right here. And so former Obama administration economist Jason Furman argued that this jump is, quote, a major crisis, end quote, on par with World War II and the 2008 financial meltdown. As he put it, quote, to see this in an economy, a 2.1 growth rate with double deficits, with low unemployment is truly stunning. There's never been anything like it. The fact that it is so big in 1 year makes you think something weird, freakish must be going on, end quote. So what that means is that for 2023, spending increased 16%, while there was a 7% decrease in revenue. And if you look at this more largely over time and you wipe out that COVID data, what you see happening is that during the Biden administration, Spending has grown significantly since pre-COVID, while simultaneously revenue has decreased. Now, again, as Foreman notes, that gap is not occurring during a period of economic stagnation, but during a period of economic strength, which is startling. So, in my opinion, and so again, this is one where we might have some differences, I see this as the huge problem for what Biden always calls his Bidenomics. And despite the fact that Trump, as I had noted earlier, was not any fixer of economic issues, this is going to be a huge problem for Biden. And I think it really takes a lot of the bubble out of what he said he'd been doing in terms of what we move forward. And I think it sets up some particularly difficult conversations in a particularly polarized age as we come towards the end of September. So what do you think about all of this, Ken?
Well, I think it's a problem, but not a huge problem. So, I mean, a couple of kind of points to keep in mind. One is that these deficits are smaller than, I believe, all the deficits that Trump ran. So we're only talking about, it has doubled since a year ago. But that was after it fell by 2/3 the year before that. So from $3 trillion down to $1 trillion and then back up to $2 trillion. And it was steady around $3 trillion through the Trump years. So I think it's not an unprecedented deficit. It's a lower than typical Trump deficit. Yeah. Then, although I generally agree that economies like the present economy, where we're not in the middle of a pandemic anymore or anything like that, or relatively full employment, that this should be a time where fiscal and monetary policy should work to bring down the deficits and not to increase the deficits. And so I agree with you that things are not moving in the right direction here. I think that the problem is we're kind of in second best world here because you have a Congress that caused essentially 100% of this deficit with the 2017 tax cuts, which cost $3 trillion. And it's a Congress that's not going to repeal those tax cuts and is not going to really do anything on the revenue side. And so I think, with that on the being part of the context here, if the question is which is worse, is it worse to run a $2 trillion deficit or is it worse to make $2 trillion in budget cuts? I think it's worse to make the $2 trillion in budget cuts. So I think we're actually, within the framework we're in, I think the we're in, if tax increases are off the table, then this is a problem, but it's the lesser evil.
See, and this is where I have a fundamental problem with Democrats on this front, right? The kind of uneasy alliance that you have described there, which is we are not going to back. And this is an issue I had with Republicans, right? We're not going to back the going after and ensuring that we're bringing in the money that we're supposed to bring in, right? That was one of the things. We can't spend money on that. But at the same time, having these discussions to say, okay, well, second best world is we spend money like we're bringing it in, even though we were going to tacitly recognize that we're not going to actually bring that money in. And the answer, the long-term answer has been, hey, the system can take that hit. The system can take that hit. And that surely is the case. But the system can only take that hit so many times. And I think one of the things that makes this particularly troubling is that, as you had noted and kind of agreed, right, this is going to be the first time in contemporary history where we're seeing this level of increase combined with a period of growth. Which means that if we end up having a period, if we do have some kind of recession or a slowdown to the economy, which of course, remember, that's what the Fed is attempting to do, and I'm not suggesting that's necessarily wrong, but if they succeed in that, what that means is that it will undoubtedly be an even bigger percentage as we move into the following year. And that depends on how long that period of stagnation might exist. So I think one of the problems that especially my libertarian friends have had who kind of come out of that old 1990s when Ron Paul was more focused primarily on economic issues back then was, next year's the year, next year's the year, next year's the year, next year's the year. And I always really took issue with that. But there is, in fact, kind of that point. And that's where I have some disagreement to say, oh, well, it's a second best world and we can live in the second best world indefinitely. And I think the answer is we really can't live in that second best world indefinitely. And as I noted a second ago, when you account for, you know, look, if you, when you take a look at that deficit spending as part of the GDP, it's relatively flat from 16 until we get to COVID, relatively. Then COVID, let's just, again, there's all kinds of things, as even Jay had said, you know, we're all monetary policy guys now. You have this huge increase. But in the aftermath, during the Biden times, you see a significant increase. And again, I'm not attributing that all to Biden. I'm just saying that that is indicator of, I'm not sure I can go down your path of, hey, the system can sustain this forever and indefinitely. And again, I'm not trying to be Ron Paul and say, hey, next year's the year where gold, you know, everybody has to, you know, no. But these, I think, are something that we can't keep just saying, well, we'll live with the second best forever. What's your response to that?
Well, I'm not even sure about that. I think maybe we can live with the second best forever, but what I'm more sure of is that we can certainly live with it now, right? I mean, usually the main rap against running big deficits is that it's inflationary, but in fact, right now we know that inflation has been tamed again. You know, I know a lot of people don't believe that because the prices went up a lot a year ago and they didn't come back down in a deflationary sense, but they aren't going up anymore, and that's even now. If you include the volatile stuff like food and energy, which for a while they would exclude, you know, even not just the core inflation, but the overall inflation, it's pretty tame. And so I don't think we see deficits causing problems of any particular sort. We still have pretty full employment. So, you know, we have a pretty good economy right now in terms of all possible measures of the real economy at the same time that we have these big deficits. So, you know, if the idea is, well, we can't run these kind of deficits forever, eventually they're going to cause us some harms. You know, that could be an argument for starting to trim them back at a time when, you know, trimming them back would reduce some of those harms. But right now, trimming back this deficit would cause harms. And running the deficit, I'm not seeing any harms that it's causing. And again, I don't even know, I don't have all the numbers in front of me, so I can't dispute what you said. But I don't believe that this is the first time when, even in the 21st century, when we've had periods of both growth and increases in deficit. I think the deficit increased under G.W. Bush, and I know it increased quite a lot under Trump to much higher levels than we're seeing now. And so I think
no,
every
it
time
did. Now, but to be fair, because I do have it in front of me, and I'm not trying to use that as a disadvantage. Yeah. The preponderance of that happens during the years I was kind of cutting out. Now, I would still want to hold Trump and Congress accountable for their COVID spending, but I recognize that I'm in the minority for that. So if you cut out the COVID spending, you know, it doesn't jump the way that one might, not as large as you would want to expect. It's during his COVID period that that has its biggest, you know, as you get into March of 2020.
Yeah, and I finally just did bring up the numbers, and I can see that, you know, that the numbers, the deficit numbers are higher now. You're absolutely right about that. Than they were in the years that I was thinking of. So I want to rescind my thought that they might not have been. You're definitely right about that. But that if we're currently running something along the lines of an 11 to 12% budget deficit, that's pretty high by historic standards. It's certainly at least in peacetime. But I would still say, you know, that the main causes of that are on the revenue side, right? That we had two series of big tax cuts, first under G.W. Bush and then again under Trump in 2017, which starved the country of revenues to pay its bills. And we would not have these deficits if it wasn't for those tax cuts. And meanwhile, you know, nobody except for the very far right within the Republicans is talking about making the spending cuts that would be necessary to pay for those tax cuts. So I think that if we're not going to make these spending cuts, and I think we should not make them, that they would all cause much, much more harm to the economy. If we got rid of Social Security, if we got rid of Medicare, if we dramatically reduced the size of our military, these kind of things are going to cause far more harms than this budget deficit is costing us. And so I think the best world would be, you know, restore the tax rates that can pay for the bills. But the second best rate is the second best thing is, you know, just borrow money to pay the bills until we actually see what harm that's causing.
Okay, so I'm going to move us forward a little bit, Ken, and we're going to move internationally for a second to an area of interest. And so Mexico had a big shift in when it came to the courts with their high Supreme Court finding that abortion is going to be federally legal. Now, that means a little bit something different than what we think of in the United States. But this has kind of been something you've been following. So I'm going to kind of let you set us up on that one, Ken.
Yeah. So in Mexico, Mexico had its version of Roe versus Wade just this week, and it's not as complete as our version of Roe versus Wade is, and I'll explain the federalism aspect of it. But I think the trend is definitely in a very pro-choice direction. So in the United States version of federalism, at the time that, as everyone knows, I think at the time that Roe versus Wade was decided, and abortion was therefore protected as a constitutional right, that ruling was applicable everywhere in the United States. So it made it overturned all state laws that prohibited abortion. In Mexican federalism, a Mexican Supreme Court ruling does not overturn the laws of the states, but it does apply in federal installations that are in the states. So what that means is that when the Mexican Supreme Court decides that abortion is now, as of this week, a protected constitutional right under the Mexican Constitution, states can still have laws that prohibit it, and they can still enforce those laws within their states, but they can't enforce those laws in federal installations. And since there is a national healthcare system there and there's a lot of federal hospitals, that means that abortion can be performed in the federal hospitals everywhere in Mexico, but can't necessarily be performed in private clinics in states that'll still prohibit it. But that Mexican Supreme Court decision follows several Mexican state Supreme Court decisions that had already ruled similarly in several of the states. And so the great trend right now in Mexico, you know, this year is a kind of a big legal shift to protect abortion rights. And I just thought it was worth us talking about because in the United States, you know, everyone knows that our legal shift has gone obviously in the opposite direction, that Roe versus Wade was overruled by the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case last year, that many states moved quickly after that to prohibit or to revive old prohibitions against abortion or to impose great restrictions. And so, you know, we see on the one hand these kind of trends that look very opposite each other in these neighboring countries where, you know, we're Mexico is moving towards abortion liberalization, right, while the United States is moving towards recriminalizing or greatly restricting aspects of abortion in some places. But I guess my view about how I was thinking about this, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this because we might find some disagreement here, is that I think that says more about the issue of how defective and weak American democracy is than anything about the issue of abortion. Because it seems to me what we're really seeing here is that in both countries, public opinion is moving increasingly pro-choice. And that in Mexico, there's a mechanism where, you know, as public opinion moves, the restrictions get liberalized. And of course, Mexico is a Catholic country and traditionally a socially conservative country, and they have much more of a legacy of restricting abortion than we do. And a lot of that's still alive, but it's being liberalized. Whereas here, you know, when the Supreme Court and some of the gerrymandered state legislatures, you know, have moved to restrict abortion rights that people previously enjoyed, you see almost not only do you see almost a uniform outcome in states where every state, no matter how red or how blue, that's put any kind of abortion question on a public ballot. And they, you know, they range in what's asked on the ballot, but the side that's more pro-choice has won 100% of these. And some, you know, some state legislative elections and some congressional elections seem to have been influenced by the issue in the post-Dobbs environment, primarily on the pro-choice side. And the other thing I noticed is that the Guttmacher Institute in the United States, which studies abortion and sexual and reproductive health issues, did a pretty detailed study where they compared rates of abortions and numbers of abortions in the United States first 6 months of 2022, overall response to Dobbs, where, you know, both politically in terms of ballot initiatives and numerically in terms of a number of abortions obtained, you know, the shift all seems to be in the same direction as what we're seeing in Mexico, but yet our political system is, I believe, so defective that what you're not seeing is that being reflected in what legislatures are doing.
Well, you know, as we had talked about before the show, Mexico was not an area that I was most familiar with. You know, when I think of Latin America and where I've studied, I spent a lot of time in thinking about Brazil, studying about Brazil. And so one of the things I had to kind of look at and think about was, well, you know, how similar or different is Mexico from the rest of Latin America? Now, for listeners, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is these are primarily Catholic countries. And so they're demographically on some of these items very different than the United States. So even today, I had to look up the most recent stats. But even today, as of 2023, you know, in Brazil, you know, only 26% of respondents want legalized abortion, and 70% want to ban abortion in all or most cases, right? That is huge. In Mexico, so I had to kind of compare and take a look at this, it's a little, it's not as drastic as Brazil, but it's a little closer to Brazil than it is for the United States. So right now, again, is the spring of 2023, Mexico stands at 46% for legalizing abortion and 50% for banning in all or most of the cases. So you actually still have a slight majority for banning abortion in Mexico rather than the United States. Now, the United States, although you kind of think of it like you were saying, Ken, it, you know, it's flipped the other way. The population is flipped likewise the other direction, right? So it's legalizing at 62% and banning at only 36%. You know, so much, much lower. So, I mean, you make an interesting argument, but in some ways it kind of seems like although the courts have gone different directions, they have gone different directions despite the opposite political preference. And so maybe these are in both cases where we're seeing just the fact that courts don't necessarily or even often respond to all public pressures, because, again, you would, you know, if they were responding to public pressure, at least that initial look at the data would suggest that Mexico might have ruled the other direction, unless you're assuming that they're trying to like look for, you know, do a forward look at that. But that made me seem a little less likely. I'm not sure. Again, I don't have close, just my brief thought about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm very grateful that you got those opinion numbers, because I didn't know them. But I guess the way I would think about this, again, largely, you know, being agreeing with the things that you said, is that Mexico seems to be on more of a path, probably because it is closer to the United States and influenced by U.S. media and has more interaction with Americans than the countries further south into Latin America. I think, you know, Mexico probably is on a path where the numbers of, you know, a few decades ago would have been more like the numbers in the 20s that you're talking about in Brazil. And so moving towards the high 40s pro-choice, even while the majority may still be anti-choice, you know, small majority, that's definitely a trajectory in a pro-choice direction. And I do think that, you know, courts often, you know, capture trajectories, so that, for instance, if you think about when our Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education, you know, that had to be kickstarted by the court. The legislatures weren't doing that themselves, but it was in the movement of where public opinion was going, and that's one of the reasons why, even though there was resistance to it in some sections of the country, you know, it was widely seen as a good decision, because I think it was kind of harnessing the trajectory that public opinion was going. And I that's kind of how my sense of politicizing marriage towards a moment where, you know, the populace is becoming much more accepting of it. So I take it your point that Mexico may not be over the tipping point yet, and that the court's decision there may have been counter majoritarian in the moment. But I think it was riding the trend
wave
there.
Yeah, we'll have to move on. But I will say, you know, one kind of prediction I was thinking about as you were talking about it, and I had been thinking about the numbers there, you know, one weird thing is, you know, and I don't know what the Mexican, I don't have all the data, you know, the longitudinal data there. But in the United States, of course, right, those numbers have shifted in the post-Dobbs, away from abortion rights activists. I mean, excuse me, towards pro-choice activists, right, in the wake of Dobbs. I wonder if the converse would be true in Mexico. So it would be kind of an interesting case example where you can kind of do a true comparison case. You know, I'm a comparativist too, so right, you know, and take a look. So you have Dobbs in the United States, and we have seen those numbers trend away from individuals like myself towards more open choice options. And then in Mexico, since you have maybe a slightly in the other way, it'll be curious to see, do the polling numbers continue in the direction of choice, or do they shift a little bit in response to that towards pro-life advocates?
Yeah, that will be an interesting thing to see. I think my prediction would be that this court in Mexico was kind of catching a wave, and that things will keep moving in the same direction they have been. But you could be right. There could be a backlash. I'm actually surprised. The number you gave for the U.S., which was 62, I'm pleased to hear it, but it's higher than I was expecting.
Because, again, it has trended in that direction post-Dobbs. That has been a clear – I mean, again, whenever you think about it, that's just the empirical, you know, nature of it. And if anybody, you know, if you're a listener, if you want to take a look at that, that is from Pew Research, if you'd like to take a look at some more of the statistics that relates to that. So, Ken, we're running low on time, but we did want to do one last thing. It's kind of a politics guy's tradition, and that is the week of Labor Day to do a state of the labor union in the United States. And so I thought we might do that a little bit. Now, this might be a little bit ironic, and I had saved this because I was curious about your reaction. You know, I don't get Labor Day off. So I actually had to come in on Labor Day, and I was working on Monday while the rest of you all were grilling out and doing whatever you're doing. be that as it may, right? I thought we kind of set that up, and maybe we can chat for just a couple minutes about this. But one of the things that we've seen is there has been a lot of increase in favorability polls towards unions in the United States in the last few years, especially in 2022 and 2023. However, that has not changed kind of the empirical reality of where labor unions have been. So labor unions, data for this really goes back to 1917 approximately, and labor unions really take off in the late 1930s and into the 1950s. By the time you get to the end of the 1950s, starting in the 1960s, membership not precipitously, but steadily begins to decline. And that pattern of steady decline never shifts. It never looks back. It's almost a perfect line. So today, union membership is on par where union membership was in the 1917s, which is just around 10% of workers, give or take. And this corresponds, of course, with an overall decrease in minimum wage for individuals around the country. So if you take a look at the Treasury data, the Wall Street Journal does a really good take a look at this. You know, in 1968, for example, it's going to take 19 hours of work to afford rent in San Jose, which is the most expensive in the data set. And it would only, and today it would take 85 hours of work at minimum wage. Even in the cheapest of cities in the data set, which is Toledo, Ohio, not far from you, Ken, you know, it was 15 hours in 1968. And today it's 27 hours again. And if you take a look at things like owning a home, it hasn't ever come back. You know, I know that from those on the left, they often see this as being kind of the disconnect, the classic disconnect. I had a professor who I say, this is just proof. This was kind of one of his areas. He worked on this in graduate school. He's like, this is just proof. You know, you can't kind of trust the average voter, which always kind of made me chuckle a little bit. Because I thought, you know, the rest outside of this issue, he always wanted people to vote on more and more things. And I thought, well, if you think that this many people can screw up so badly, why would you want them to vote? I always felt like that was a weird disconnect there from somebody kind of on the union left. I'm not actually completely anti-union, but it doesn't appear that any of the empirical realities that individuals have today has driven them to the unions, even while it has potentially made them like the idea of them more. It certainly hasn't changed how anybody has behaved in large ways or changed the number of unions. Again, since the 1960s to now, as they've just kind of trickled off. And so labor in the United States for me, Ken, seems to have kind of, I mean, whether you loved it or hated it, I think it kind of lost.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. In fact, one of the interesting flips from 100 years ago, you mentioned that the numbers are back down to around 10% of employees, which is about what it was in the 1910s. Probably in the 1910s, that most of those would have been private sector employees, whereas today it's disproportionately public sector employees. True. That are still unionized. And I think the reason that public sector employees have hung on a little bit better in some areas of the country than private is that in some places it wouldn't be popular for the government to try to union bust. You know, now in other places, the governments, have just as free of a hand as any private employer to try to union bust. And I think they can succeed in doing that when they want to. But you do have areas of the country where, that's not what the voters want. And so those are the few places where public sector unions, I think, have managed to hang on. I think there's a lot of reasons for the decline in the labor movement. I think a lot of it does have to do with basically the decline in the kinds of jobs where people actually think they're going to stay at the same job for a long time. And I think that if if people have a commitment to being in a place, being in a city, being with an employer, they're more likely to want to put the investment of time and effort and money into unionizing and trying to make their workplace a better situation for themselves. Whereas if people don't feel that connected to the workplace, there's no real reason to do that, to make that investment. So I think that's a big part of it. I think professional tactics by management strategists, which have really been directed at thwarting the development of unions, have been somewhat successful. But I don't think the American workforce is better off for the demise of unions. I don't think the gig economy is a great thing for American workers, and so I think it's a sad state of affairs. But I certainly can't disagree with your assessment that that's where we are.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to say, Ken, if anybody's listening to that, I think that's it for the show this week. So thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
So, if you've already made it this far and you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I really hope you'd consider to become one, right? Because it's supporters that make this podcast go. And you don't have to just do it out of the kindness of your own heart, right? You don't have to be some altruistic individual. You can be doing it because you want to get a lot of cool, good stuff. Like, for example, the ad-free versions of everything we put out, as well as, I think, one of our coolest things, which is our supporter-exclusive midweek show. As a matter of fact, here in just a couple of minutes, Ken and I, we're not going to take a break yet. We're going to be headed over and continuing our dive through the United States Constitution, which has just been really phenomenal. Listeners have really loved it. And I'd love for you to be able to join Ken and myself as we head into Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. And don't feel bad. The great thing about it is you don't just get them week by week. You get the whole go. So that means that you basically have a book's worth of material from me and myself and Ken on the United States Constitution. And that has just been phenomenal. You can join us on that. And we've got a lot left to do. We're going to be heading into the amendments and more in the upcoming weeks. So we'd really love to have you. And that's one of the big things you get when you become a supporter. But there's all other kinds of things, too. So supporters are going to get to be a part of our very active Discord group. I'm on there constantly. There's Politics Guys in gear. And you're going to see all of these different things at the different levels of support. So if you want to check that out, see what those different levels of support are and what you get, just head to patreon.com/politicsguys. Head to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can see those levels of support right on show.com/support. So again, patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support, or just scroll down with your thumb and check out those links in the show notes. Now, if you'd like to get that midweek show, you want to join us for Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, but you're just not in a financial position to do that right now, we get that. All you got to do is just shoot a little bit of an email to mail@politicsguys.com, and we can get you set up on that mailing list. Now, whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate, review on whatever podcast app you use and share those episodes on social media. Maybe Ken got it wrong. Maybe I got it wrong on the deficit, and you want to call us out for it. Yeah, share this episode and tell us what we got right and wrong. We'd love to see there and interact with you there as well. If you've got a question, comment, correction, gripe, manifesto, or just anything else you'd like to share with us, You can always reach the guys at politicsguys, mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and again, you'll find all of those things in the show notes. A special shout out, as always, to the executive producers of the Politics Guys, who are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. I hope you'll be back with us next week. New episode. Hope you'll join us then.